Hey everyone, it's Abadesi, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. Today, I'm joined by Cassidy Williams. She's a senior software engineer at CodePen and previously worked at Amazon, Clarifai, and Venmo. I am a huge fan of her social media presence and all the public speaking that she does. She talks about all things related to tech, design, coding, and product. She's a true maker. We cover a lot in this episode: the future of programming, the rise of niche communities, defining success as a software engineer, and mechanical keyboards and other products that she loves. You're in for a treat. Cassidy, or shall I say Cassidy, your Twitter alias, thank you so much for being with us today on Product Hunt Radio. I enjoy everything you do online and also the work that you do advocating for greater diversity and inclusion in tech, but also just kind of breaking down the barriers to like understanding what life as a software engineer is like. However, for people who don't follow you on social media yet or aren't super familiar with the things that you've done, please tell us who you are and what you're working on.
Sure. So, hey, everyone. My name is Cassidy Williams, and I'm a software engineer at CodePen. And for those who don't know what CodePen is, it's an online IDE playground to mess with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript and all the libraries and preprocessors and stuff associated with that. So you can make art with code, prototype things, all kinds of stuff. I work remotely, actually, from home. The company is really small. We're only 8 people working on it. And so we work as a tight-knit team building CodePen for all of our users. And it's a really great time. And because I work from home, I have a lot of flexibility to work on side projects and do fun things. And so I do a lot of public speaking at conferences and meetups and hackathons and stuff. And I'm also very into mechanical keyboards, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit later into the podcast.
Definitely.
I like to build a bunch of different keyboards and fun both hardware and software projects and just kind of make things on the side. And yeah, that's generally me in a nutshell.
Oh, well, you've pretty much mentioned all of the things that Product Hunt love. One, remote teams and distributed working. Ryan Hoover, our CEO and founder, is a huge advocate of that. We're a fully distributed team. So I'm here in London speaking to you in Seattle. We've got engineers in India and Bulgaria. I have teammates in Belgium and France. I'm a huge, huge supporter of flexible working and remote working. So I hope this is a trend that continues in tech. And you're also a maker, which we love. You're a tinkerer, you're into products, and you're working on a lot of different things, including public speaking, which is incredibly impressive. I wanted to start by just asking you what you worked on before you got to CodePen and how you sort of ended up there.
Oh, yeah. So I've been kind of a hopper between jobs, I guess, for lack of a better word. So I've been at CodePen for actually almost a year now, which kind of blows my mind. Time flies when you're having fun. But I graduated from school back in 2014 from Iowa State University with my computer science degree. And from there, I went straight to Venmo. And I was kind of early on at Venmo. The company was bought like right after I signed my offer letter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was an interesting time to be at Venmo. And I was both a software engineer and a developer evangelist there. And for those who don't know what developer evangelism is, that's kind of a combination of software engineering and marketing. And so I would show people how to use the Venmo API at hackathons. I would go represent us at events and just kind of show people what Venmo was all about. What was exciting about that is because Venmo was bought, I was able to partner with evangelists from Braintree and from PayPal and from eBay. And then eBay and PayPal ended up splitting while I was there. And it was a very kind of crazy time at the company. But it was fun to learn a lot, both about the dev evangelism side and about the software engineering side, since it was my first job out of school. And I was there for a little over a year. I was approached by a small startup called Clarifai, which was an artificial intelligence startup. And I was interested, but I was very happy at Venmo. It was something that I wasn't entirely sure if I should switch. And after getting a bunch of advice from mentors, and I made a giant pros and cons list between my current job and the new job, and showed it to coworkers and to mentors and stuff, I was really just advised that switching was a good move for me because things were changing with the company buyout and my job might not be as interesting as it was because the Venmo API was going to be deprecated, all kinds of things.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And so it ended up being a good move for me. And I switched over to Clarify. And Venmo was in New York and Clarify was in New York as well. And at Clarify, what was cool about their APIs and developer tools were you could pass in an image or video to the API and it would return a list of tags for that API. And so I could take a picture of my computer in front of me. And if I put it through the API, it would return computer, technology, business, keyboards,
awesome.
Stuff like that. Yeah. And so it really made for a bunch of really interesting applications. And so I led up developer evangelism for Clarify. And I say led up, there were two of us, myself and my sister, for a really long time.
Oh, cool.
We were the 17th and 18th employees at Clarify. So it was a really small company and a really cool opportunity to make a really big impact. And we were both software engineers and dev evangelists for them. And we took them all over the country. We and even the world. We went to a bunch of events outside of the US as well. And the API was really exciting and fun to work with. And after a while, even though I was really loving my job, I wasn't really loving the location I was in anymore. And unfortunately, Clarify was not as set up for remote work as our two companies are. So, So I was kind of deciding where I wanted to end up and decided on Seattle. And so I ended up going out to Seattle and I joined a small company called L4 Digital. And they were a creative agency. And I say were because unfortunately L4 is no more. But while I was there, it was a really awesome place where I was just a straight software engineer there. I wasn't doing dev evangelism, but it was because it was a creative agency, I was able to do a bunch of client work. And so with the client work, I was able to work on a project for a company. And then after I was done, after 3 months, move on to the next project. And so it was a really good learning experience to work on a bunch of different code bases in a bunch of different languages. And I was a manager there where I had managed a couple people at Clarify as the company had grown. I think I ended up managing 3 people there. But at L4, I was able to manage 6 senior engineers and really kind of just grow a ton with them. What was exciting about L4 was because it was a creative agency, they were very keen on work-life balance in that they were saying, our clients never pay us for more than 40 hours a week. And so why would you work more than 40 hours a week?
Well, that's sensible.
Yeah. It kind of blew my mind, especially coming from a startup and coming from the New York tech scene. It was a very different change of pace that made it exciting because suddenly I had more time outside of work. And because I wasn't going to conferences every single weekend and speaking all the time, I was able to kind of pursue hobbies that I hadn't been anymore. And that's where I really got into mechanical keyboards. The mechanical keyboard scene here in Seattle is enormous, actually. I kind of consider myself very into keyboards, but man, I've only scratched the surface compared to some of the people in Seattle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's fun. And so I learned how to solder. My company had a laser cutter and a 3D printer. So I started messing with those and really just got into making and building things a lot more outside of work because I had the freedom and ability to. And so working at L4 was such a great experience. And similar to Venmo, they were bought. And the company that bought them, a very large tech company based in Argentina who wanted to expand into the United States. And unfortunately, L4 does not exist anymore. It was completely swallowed up by that company, but it was a really great place to work and kind of, it helped me determine more what I wanted out of a job. I wanted to be able to have that freedom. I wanted to be able to have that ability to make things and learn a lot. And it was a really great experience. And so I was there for a little over a year, maybe a year and a half. And then the changes started to come and I started to realize that I was going to have to make a switch. So by that time, my husband and my sister, they were both working at Amazon and they were kind of just like, well, it's Amazon. You're in Seattle. You might as well make the switch. And so I started interviewing with Amazon and right as I was about to accept my offer with Amazon, I was reached out by CodePen and they just kind of literally slid into my DMs and were just like, hey, you want to talk about a job? And I love CodePen. It was a tool that I'd been using forever. Both at Clarify and at L4, we would have CodePen Mondays where we would just get in a room and then try to make something on CodePen and just experiment with it. And so I loved the product. And so even though I already had a job offer, I was just like, okay, full disclosure, I have an offer, but I would like to interview with you anyway, just because I love this and I love your product. And so I interviewed with CodePen and got the offer, and oh, it was so tempting because I loved it. But the Amazon offer was also very lucrative and financially. And I was just like, you know what? I could pay off a bunch of loans. I could do all kinds of great things if I worked at Amazon. And so even though my heart was kind of with CodePen, my sense of logic, I guess, was with Amazon. And so I joined, and I kind of immediately regretted it. Following the cash rather than following kind of what I really wanted to work on. It was a lesson I definitely learned the hard way. And I tried to make the most of my time at Amazon, but I kind of knew like a week in that I shouldn't have joined. Full disclosure, there's plenty of awesome teams at Amazon. There's lots of places where people really love working there. Unfortunately, I was not on one of those very awesome teams and had a lot of issues both with diversity in the workplace and not being able to get my work done as a result of a lack of an inclusive environment and many other things, and just politics in general. And my work-life balance wasn't that great. They weren't as keen on side projects. It was a whole... And so I lasted 6 or 7 months, and there was a point where I was just like, you know what, this just wasn't worth it. And so I reached back out to the CodePen team and I said, I'm so sorry, I made a mistake. Please take me back. And they did. And it was awesome. And so I was able to luckily leave on good terms with the team at Amazon and switch over to CodePen. And that's where I've been ever since. And it was a really good time to join because the team is fully remote. They happened to be doing a big kind of company retreat like that next month. And so I was able to join the company and meet people right away and just get to know everyone. And it's been awesome ever since. We've been able to launch a bunch of really cool features. I've been able to have my flexibility back to be able to go to a lot more meetups and build a lot more things and do a lot more things. I also joined a nonprofit, the board of a nonprofit here in Seattle called C Keys, where we build mechanical keyboards and we run workshops to show kids and people from underrepresented groups how electronics work, how soldering works and stuff through keyboards. And
that's so cool.
It's really fun. And we help run the Seattle Mechanical Keyboard Meetup, which is about 400 people.
Wow, you weren't kidding then.
Yeah, no, I'm serious. The Seattle Mechanical Keyboard scene is huge. Like, people have flown in from Australia, from other states, from all over the place. Yeah, it's a massive event, and it's really exciting. It's going to actually be later this month, which we're prepping and getting ready for that. But
ooh, how exciting.
Anyway, yeah, it's all very exciting, and that's kind of how I ended up where I am today, and it's been
your meandering journey as you pursued fulfillment. It's so enlightening. And before I kind of go on to my next question about how, you know, you define success for yourself as an individual, you know, your vision of a successful software engineering career for you, I wanted to go back a little bit to what you mentioned about Amazon, only because I really felt like my experience was mirrored in what you went through. So I used to work at Amazon as well. I was actually like headhunted out of a business development role that I was doing at Groupon. I'd been at Groupon for like 3 years. I joined when it was like relatively early here in London, but you know, I stayed, we IPO'd, and then, you know, when you have shares that are restricted, like you often have to like stay for some time after the IPO before you can actually like cash them out. So I was sort of in that situation. And when Amazon reached out to me, I was incredibly excited because I was like, holy moly, it's Amazon, it's huge. And very similar experience to you, like, you know, having gone through all of the interview stages, which, you know, Amazon has a very diligent interview like system. I think I did like 7 or 8 interviews. You get to this point where you're given this offer and it's, you know, cash, it's a bonus, it's like equity. And, you know, the dollar signs flashed in my eyes. And it's funny because I was in a mindset where I wanted to go back to an early stage company, or at least like a company that was in a like really intensive scaling period, because I just find that really fun, building all the processes, learning as you go along, like moving at breakneck speed. And I knew that Amazon was not that, because Amazon was one of the more mature tech companies. But still, similar to you, I was like, oh, God, I've got credit card bills. Yeah. I literally had like a credit card bill from Coachella, and I was like, I need to pay that. And so, you know, I accepted the Amazon offer, and same kind of thing that you described. I remember sitting in the office, like, could have maybe been like my first day, and just thinking, oh no, I wanted a startup environment, and I'm actually in like a huge mega corporate environment, right? And you know, no shade on Amazon. I love Amazon. I'm like a diehard Prime customer. I still have many friends that work there. When you're a company that employs hundreds of thousands of individuals, you have to organize yourself in a way that feels very different to a small company or an early stage startup. And like you, I learned that the hard way. And now I often tell people who are debating between going an early stage into a tech company, or like going into like an older tech company, but that's decided to stay small, or like an older tech company that's gone huge enterprise. I always say to them, you know, there are very different experiences as a worker in terms of, you know, flexibility, autonomy, reporting structures, et cetera. So really think through like what amount of like bureaucracy and processes you're content with, because that will like change what makes you happy. And interestingly enough as well, I remember looking at the org chart at Amazon with my colleagues. So we were like a bank of desks that were all women. And we would look at like Jeff Bezos and then all the levels below, and they were all guys. And I know that that's quite common in tech, unfortunately. But that was certainly like a sort of like penny dropping in my mind, where I kind of thought, wow, like, is there space for us there? Are there companies that have us at that level? So it's just so funny that you had that too.
Yeah, it was looking at the org chart, and just in my organization in general, like there were not many women in leadership. And it was the kind of thing where when I brought up that it was an issue, it was kind of brushed off. And there were plenty other experiences that probably shouldn't be said on a podcast that were just like, man, diversity is just not a priority on this team. And I'm sure that some teams do have it as a priority, but when you see at the very top that it's not really diverse at all, and then also your individual team isn't at all either, and it's not a priority, it definitely makes you think.
And exactly. Yeah, no, I really appreciate you sharing that. So let's talk a bit about your personal definition of a successful software engineering career. I'm quite curious to hear about, you know, what motivates you and what you seek out in work, because you've sort of gone in startups, you've gone in big tech companies. And it's an interesting question to ask someone who, you know, studied computer science, went straight into engineering roles, because we're at a time right now where you've got things like Lambda School that are, you know, turning people who didn't train originally in higher education or whatever as engineers, turning them into that with this, you know, amazing incentive of, you know, six-figure salary, or, you know, like a lot of people are basically like switching into engineering to make money, which is great for them and it's awesome. But many people don't actually prioritize income as something that they feel makes their career successful. So I'm just curious, you know, as an engineer yourself, what's your definition of success?
For the record, I think being in it for the money, that's necessary for some people. And that's a really good reason to be in it, for sure. And I think for myself, I luckily have the privilege of not being in it for the money, and because I actually do love it. And yes, the money is great, and I'm able to afford things because of it, but I really genuinely do love it. And my definition of success is just having the flexibility to build whatever I want. And right now I'm building for CodePen, but because my job is so flexible, I'm able to build things outside of work. And someday I would love to be able to just not have to work and just build things for fun outside of work, whether it be for money or not for money. I love building things in general, whether it be keyboards, code, Legos, all kinds of fun things. I would love to be able to get into carpentry and build chairs. I really like just putting things together, doing things both with my hands and just with math and with logic and creativity. And so the flexibility aspect for me is I think what is successful. And when I was first getting into the workforce, I don't think that was my goal. I was definitely like, I want to be a VP of engineering. I want to be a CTO or a CEO. I want to climb that career ladder. And I really felt that in pretty much every job I went to. And I was always kind of looking to see, how can I take on more work so that way I can climb up this ladder? In my first job on the job, I made sure that I had an intern so I could get management experience. So at my next job, I was able to manage three people. And then at my next job, I was able to manage a team of senior engineers. And then by the time I was at Amazon, my title was head of developer voice programs. I was ahead of something. I was really excited. Yeah. And so it was fun. But then I think that experience, especially at L4 and Amazon, they kind of gave me a taste of both the leadership aspect, but also the freedom aspect. And I started to realize having that freedom to build and make things in and outside of work was starting to feel more and more important than it was for me to lead and be at the top of a given career ladder of some sort or political ladder in a company. Again, at Amazon, I really realized, dang, being close to the top while still not even being close to the top is not as exciting as I thought it would be. It just gets more political the more you go up the career ladder. And so that's something that I used to think. And I think it was, even though it was a really tough learning experience for me, it was a good one, because I really realized having the freedom to do things, build things, and have a life outside of work without having to work super late hours and things, that was definitely more important to me. And I guess that's kind of how I've matured in my personal definition of success, because I care a lot more about being able to do things outside of work and the ability to do that as my metric for success, rather than just being at the top of a given organization.
I love that. I think there's a lot to be said, particularly from the experiences you've just shared, about doing things that you actually don't like to find out what it is you do like. You know what I mean? Like, to some extent, do you feel that, like, had you not had some of those experiences which actually didn't, like, turn out the way you expected them to, you then wouldn't know that you're so drawn to, you know, having the space to make stuff and be more creative outside of work?
Totally. Yeah. And I think that's something that, like, I don't regret going to Amazon. I don't regret doing certain things in my career. I've learned different things at every single job that have really helped shape what I want in a career, for sure. And I do think it's important to know both what you want to do and what you don't want to do. And there was a great talk I heard by Rebecca Garcia, and she's a technologist in the industry. And she once said, when you're talking about your personal brand as a developer, as a maker, as a product manager, as any of these things, you do want to be able to showcase what you can do, what you want to do, but you also have to be very aware of what you don't want to do. And that's something that really rang true for me and has kind of stuck in my mind ever since I heard her say it, because it's true. Like, I could say, oh, I'm going to be at this really fancy, legit company, but I'm going to be working in C++ doing hardcore, like, backend and kernel work and stuff. That does not sound like my idea of a good time. Why would I do that? And someone might love that. And meanwhile, being at CodePen, I love being able to be on this small team where I work on languages that I care about, on a product that I care about, and having the freedom to do things outside of work and that's it. Like, I can't really be promoted at CodePen because there's 8 of us and I don't mind. And that's something that I feel like past Cassidy, her mind might be blown at the fact that I can't really be promoted at my current job.
But, yeah.
But it's great. And it's definitely something that I've learned to be happy with over time because of all of these experiences.
That's amazing. Thanks so much for sharing.
So I know that many of our listeners spend most of their day in Gmail and Google Calendar and Drive, pretty typical stuff. And typically, you're managing relationships with anyone from freelancers to clients to investors to vendors to partners to customers. You get the idea. It's a lot. But what if there's a way to remember every name instantly, find every email thread, even from weeks ago, and never forget to follow up on anything again? Because, let's face it, who has the time for that? That's what Copper's for. It's your designated relationship manager, built to look and feel like the G Suite apps you know and love. Actually, it's recommended for G Suite by Google Cloud. Plus, it lets every team, sales, marketing, customer success, and even product, talk to each other and share updates all in one place. If that doesn't sound like a CRM, you're right. Copper isn't your average CRM. See for yourself. Check out copper.com/producthunt to try a 14-day free trial.
I wanted to dig a little bit into your life as a maker and your life as a creator. A lot of the people in the product and community would identify with, you know, those ideas, with those titles. We have a part of our website called Makers, producthunt.com/makers, and it's a place for people to share their goals, get help and support from each other, find inspiration, find team members. We can also like start discussions, so it's sort of like a forum. And one of the things that I've noticed, you know, we're still sort of in a beta phase, but there are often a lot of discussions happening around what I would call a maker mindset. So people have an idea, they have an itch to scratch, there's some kind of mental blocker or personal blocker, and they're sort of seeking advice from other people who have actually like finally launched a product out there on how to overcome that. So I guess I would like to ask you, how do you stay motivated to, you know, get projects off the ground and actually complete them?
Oh, actually completing them. Ugh, that's tougher. But that's a great question. And I think it kind of depends on your plan for getting it going. And one of my things that I've made, for example, that I have a product hunt page for, you could look it up, is I made a Scrabble keyboard, a Scrabble themed keyboard. And I was really excited about this thing that I wanted to make. I had had a dream about typing on a Scrabble like game board. And I was like, oh, what if I made that keyboard, designed a keycap set, was excited about it. And I realized, okay, there's no way that I can show this to people unless I get a license for it, because I don't own Scrabble. I don't own anything related to it. And so for a long time, it was just an idea because I had no idea how to get a license. I started cold calling people on LinkedIn. I started messaging random people that I found even on Facebook, just saying, hey, I saw that you worked for Scrabble a few years ago. How can I get a license? Or Hasbro a few years ago. And so for a long time, it was just a project idea that I've had. And I have such a long list of just ideas that I haven't pursued yet. And finally, after just a bout of really cold calling a ton, I got a license. And that was kind of a kick in the pants to say, okay, I finally gotten a license. Someone finally said, yes, I have to make this real. And I reached out to Drop, which drop.com, it used to be called MassDrop. They said that they would help me manufacture it because I met them at a keyboard meetup. And they were like, if you have the license, we can make this happen. And it happened. It was great.
Amazing.
It was really, really exciting. And that's one of those projects where I was excited about it. I was motivated to do it, but I couldn't. It was at a standstill for a very long time. And I have so many projects where they are currently at standstill. Some projects have been finished, some projects haven't been finished. And honestly, my motivation kind of comes and goes with how I'm doing at that given time. When I'm particularly stressed at work or with something in life and things, my productivity stops. Where if I've had a really stressful day at work for whatever reason, like for example, when I was at Amazon all the time, when I've had a particularly stressful time at work, I don't do things outside of work because I just want to calm my brain. And so I play video games, I read a book, I kind of just stay still and don't do things because I just can't fathom having to work on something outside of work when things inside of my day job just aren't going well. So luckily, with a lot of the projects I've been able to actually complete, it's been because I finally just didn't have a stressful period at work and was able to just get it out the door. And so I think a key to staying motivated is just kind of making sure everything else in your life has fallen into place, which is easier said than done, especially with life circumstances and things that everybody has to deal with. That's kind of been my way of getting things done is just making sure all of my boxes are checked, having a really maintained and curated to-do list of these are the things I want to get done today. And if I can get these done today, that means I can push out another newsletter by the end of the day. I can do this by the end of the day. I can do that. And believe me, there are plenty of times where I end up just playing video games anyway, even if it's not that stressful at work. But the times when I'm most productive are when I just get things done succinctly at work and can close my work self off and go straight to just being creative outside of work.
Amazing. I like what you've said because I see it as like a holistic way of approaching productivity. It's not necessarily helpful to look at productivity or motivation in isolation. Like, why aren't I being productive today? As you say, it's all the other things that feed into your overall day, your overall, you know, headspace and how you feel that will ultimately impact how productive you can be. At least most of the time. Yes, there are days where we just don't have it in us and that's totally fine. But yeah, like that is like one of the conversations that we have in discussions in Product Hunt Makers a lot as well, because what often happens with, you know, makers or people like you who have this endless list of ideas that, you know, just want to execute, you're always wearing lots of different hats and juggling lots of different things. And I relate to that as well. In doing that, we probably are not as good as we can be at just finding balance. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. And it's hard to balance everything. And then life happens. Like sometimes it's not just work. Sometimes it's family things. Sometimes it's,
exactly.
You got to patch a hole in the roof. It could be any combination of things that you just need to get done. And so I think a lot of people are just like, I'm just not motivated. I need to do something. And life is busy. And I think that being able to kind of clear out the busy things in life so that way you have the headspace to be productive on your side projects, I think that's a major key. If my house isn't clean, I can't be that productive on side projects, because I know for a fact that if I do this now, that means I won't have time to do laundry later. That means that I won't put my sheets on the bed. Da, 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 da. So it's a lot of stuff like that. I do think that the holistic approach is the answer to that for sure.
Amazing. Great. Well, so one of the things that we also like to talk about on this podcast is really just getting folks insight into like the future of the space in which they operate. So I kind of wanted you to like narrow in a bit on, you know, the type of programming languages that you've used, the type of software development projects that you've worked on, and share a bit with us about, you know, in the years that you've been working within software engineering, what you've like witnessed as like interesting changes and what you perceive to be like potential like changes or trends going forward.
Yeah, so that's a good question. And there have been so many interesting trends that I've seen just over the past few years. And one that I noticed in particular, just in working with React, I've been working with React since React 11, I think, which it's React 16 or 17 now. So it's
oh, wow.
Some major versions of React. And just using React as an example, when I first started working with React, there were a lot of things in it that were just magical, that just worked. And then I noticed that even though it was kind of easy to work with, you're just like, oh, cool, that just works, done. I don't have to worry about it. It was great. But people started to, a developer started to say, I want more control than this. I want to be able to know exactly how this is being bound to this and that sort of thing. And I think then React started moving to a much more granular thing where you had to specifically bind a function to a particular class and that sort of thing. And a bunch of functions were taken away and replaced. So that way it would be a lot more granular and a lot less magical. And I think that is a very interesting metaphor for a lot of things that are happening in the tech industry. I think the big push for WebAssembly is a very similar thing, where WebAssembly is working, gets as pretty much as low level as you can get for web development. And that's people wanting to be more granular with their coding and engineering practices than just using JavaScript, which is it's kind of funny to think about it that way, but it's true. And I think a lot of people are wanting to kind of get to the core of adding more and more low-level and theoretical computer science practices to web development. Even 10 years ago and 5 years ago, web development in particular was kind of considered a more, I hate to say it, soft skill. It was considered like real development, and more logic and more function is being put into the front end of particular applications. And so many applications now out there are fully single page applications because almost all the logic is on the front end. And back-end frameworks are still popular, but they aren't as necessary to know because of the power that front-end libraries are being given and the advances that are being done in the front-end space to have that more granular, more powerful code on the front end. And so I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that, a lot more just power given to higher level languages, for sure. That being said, outside of just code in general, I think I've been noticing that there's a movement just in the tech community in general for more specific communities, where instead of having the more broad, just like all of these devs are on Facebook, all of these devs are on Twitter, it's a lot more like these developers in particular are on Product Hunt and Indie Hackers. And these people over here are on a specific web animation forum. These people are in the CodePen Spectrum community. And like, it's very, very specific. It's kind of getting back to the old internet days of forums and stuff, where that's kind of where your social media was. I think I've been seeing a lot more of that, of people joining more specific types of social media rather than the large grand ones, just to find their very specific things that they want to know about a very specific technology or interest and stuff. And I think that that's a trend that I've been seeing a lot, and I think will continue to grow as people realize that they don't need to be a part of the general population for the things that they're interested in. They can be in a very niche group and get to know people in this very specific sector. And I mean, I could even say the same about mechanical keyboards. One of the most popular places to find people interested in mechanical keyboards is a random forum called Geek Hack, where if you go to it is about as old school forum as you can get, like a black background with red font and that sort of
thing. Oh, wow. It's a really old school
looking forum, but it's thriving. And that's where people see the latest manufacturing news on keyboard stuff, and where people put interest checks and group buys for different parts. And I think that is going to be growing a lot, and we're going to see a lot more of that for sure.
Yes, I love this focus on, you know, specific communities. Sometimes we talk about them at Product Hunt as, you know, niche communities. And you're right, you know, our experience of the online space is evolving. Our tastes are getting more specific, and we're connecting with other people that we can relate to in a more meaningful way. Like, the more specific we can get, the more meaningful and perhaps enjoyable it is, which is pretty cool. So you just mentioned mechanical keyboards. You tweet about mechanical keyboards a lot. I just saw the cutest thing that you had retweeted. Someone is building caps for keys in all these delightful little shapes. It's like a hamburger cap. It's amazing. I wanted to ask, where does this love of mechanical keyboards come from?
Good question. So it was something that I first started messing with them probably in 2015. And that was more just because I wanted a pretty keyboard. I was setting up my desktop at home, and I was just like, you know what? My keyboard should be fun too. And I started to realize if I really wanted to customize things to the nth degree, it meant that my keyboard had to be mechanical. And then I started looking into that. And then a coworker of mine was just like, oh, well, if you really want to customize them, and then he kind of introduced me to the world of custom switches, custom keycaps, custom cases, PCBs, electronics, cables, everything. And I just kind of got sucked in. I thought it was so interesting. And then I moved to Seattle, where, as I've mentioned on this podcast, the community is huge and so deep. I remember I went to my first keyboard meetup. I think it was like within a month of my just being in Seattle in general.
Oh, wow. A real top priority.
Yeah. Well, it was just really good timing. And I still have that keyboard that I brought there to this day. And I just remember feeling like such a noob compared to the people there. And I was just like, dang, these people have amazing keyboards. At these keyboard meetups, you bring your keyboards, you can kind of try out the things that people have done with them. Sometimes people customize their switches or lube the mechanics on the inside so it's particularly smooth. Some people model their own keycaps or have different combinations of keycap sets, all sorts of things. And so I kind of just realized what I liked a lot more as I was at this meetup, and then got more and more connected with the group. And then I just really fell in love with it. It's so fun to be able to build something that is both pretty and functional. And typing on them is actually really fun, because as I'm typing on a mechanical keyboard, it feels like I'm accomplishing something. It's not just the butterfly switches of just like poking at something. When you feel that tactile switch kind of thock as you type things, it's great, and it's just a fun thing to type on. And the keyboard in front of me right now, it has these custom switches called Xilence that are particularly tactile but still silent, and they have a certain amount of weight, 67 g actuation force, and it's a switch that I absolutely love. And then meanwhile, next to me, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 keyboards next to me that all have,
what?
Yeah, I'm looking at them right now. They're my babies. But they all have different switches. They all have different looks. They all have different shapes and sizes, and they're all unique in a different way. And, it's fun to be able to just kind of rotate out keyboards and have a different typing experience that's just fun, exciting, and feels different. And it's really fun being able to program the actual macros in there, where I have some keyboards. These keyboards are really small. For example, one of them is called a 40% keyboard. And so a full keyboard that has all of the arrow keys, that has a numpad, everything, that's called a 100%. And then if you take off the numpad, that's called like a 75% or a TKL, because it takes out the 10 keys. And then if you take off the arrow keys and then all of the function keys above the arrow keys, that's ends up being a 60% keyboard. And you have to end up programming in the arrow keys WASD or HKJL or something. And then you can get even smaller where you don't have a num row, and you can get even smaller where you only have function keys on the bottom row and that sort of thing. So you can get really, really small keyboards. But as a result, you can program them a ton. And so some of my favorite keyboards, they are these 60% boards where there's no arrow keys. And so I map So I can map my caps lock key to a function key and then use HKJL for arrows. And then I can make it so if I do function M, that mutes my volume, or I can program pretty much whatever I want in there. And I know some people who, for example, they stream a lot. And so they have a bunch of streaming functions that they programmed into their computer where they can say start stream and stop stream if I do function plus these keys. And then some people where they have multiple layers where it's not just function, but if I do function shift and then these sorts of things, that triggers a stenography mode where I can type in shorthand. Like there's so many cool things that you can do with it. And it's kind of hard for me to not go even deeper with it, but it's just a really fun experience to customize something completely your own that works really well, that makes you more productive, and that looks good too.
Oh, that's so cool. I feel like a complete noob myself now because I don't even have one. And you've just described all these myriad of ways that you can customize and play around with it. I need to look into this. I need to get involved. I often think when I look at, you know, retro technology, I miss like the tactile elements, you know, like pushing buttons, turning dials. There is something immensely gratifying about interacting with hardware in that way. And we're definitely losing some of that as we go towards touch screens and like optimizing for like, you know, lightness and like small space and all that jazz. So I love that there's this like revolution like growing and growing where people are like investing in mechanical keyboards. You've got 9 on your desk. I mean, this is incredible. I'm guessing that means that you could not pick a favorite one. Is there like one that you go to the most?
So my current favorite is the one that's in front of me where I mentioned I have those Xilence tactile switches. It has a combination of keycaps that I've collected over time. It just looks very, very retro and yet modern because it has really high profile caps that are in the shape. It's called the SA shape. And that shape was popularized on typewriters and old NASA keyboards. So it's got that retro element. But the case in particular is really heavy. It's like a 3.5-pound case. And it has customized lighting in it. And I actually got this case in Korea. And you can't get it in the United States. You can only get it outside of it. And my husband's Korean. We were visiting his family. And I was like, this is the perfect time. So I was able to get one of these keyboards that I've honestly had my eye on for like a year. And so I was finally able to get one of those, and it had hot swappable switches, so I didn't have to solder to put in my new switches that I custom got. So pretty much all the pieces in it are fully custom, and then it's kind of my precious right now. But I do have a few other ones. There's one that I didn't actually customize it at all. It's called a RealForce keyboard, and it's a RealForce silenced V2 55G Topre keyboard, which that's a lot of words, but it's like typing on a cloud. It came out recently and wasn't available in the United States for a very long time. And some friends of mine were vacationing in Singapore, and I was just like, hey friends, want to buy me a keyboard while you're on vacation, loving each other? And so it worked out. They were able to bring me the keyboard, which was awesome. And that one is so fun to type on. It's really, really quiet, but you still have the tactile feedback, and it's really, really fun. Honestly, I was just about to start describing all of my keyboards. They're all
I said favorite. You had me at typing on a cloud. That sounds awesome. One of the best flea market acquisitions I've ever made in my life was when I was a teenager. I was probably maybe 16 years old. And I went to, in the UK, we call them like car boot sales. It's kind of like a garage sale. And someone had this like military green keyboard. It was like an Olympia keyboard, I think. Because I say keyboard, because you've been talking about keyboards. I mean typewriter. So someone had a typewriter. And I was like reading into like history at that time. And I remember like reading that like Winston Churchill had one of these kind of typewriters. And so I say to this guy, I was like, wow, how much for the typewriter? And he just kind of laughed at me because he was like, no one wants a typewriter. So he was like, you can have it for £5.
What?
Yeah. And I was just like, amazing. So I like lugged this typewriter back to boarding school, and I named him Trevor. So it was Trevor the typewriter. And I would like write notes to, you know, my friends. I would like buy like ribbons of different colors, like blue ribbons, red ribbons, like black ribbons. It was actually really hard to find typewriter ribbons. I had to kind of go online and find shops that would sell them. But it was really fun. And then like I put Trevor like in the study, like the shared study room that we had. And we would just like leave reams of paper in him and like each take turns like adding lines to a story. And it was really fun. And like, as you were describing like the joy that comes from typing on a mechanical keyboard, I was reminded of my typewriter. And I was just like, that was really fun. And I also remember being a kid and my dad having a word processor. Do you remember those?
Oh, those like, were... Yeah, I think my library still has those, actually.
But that was like maybe like one of the first places where I practiced typing. And there were these huge things. I mean, we have a lot of like Gen Z people in our audience. So they're going to be like, what is that? I'm going to Google image search that. Yeah, you've certainly inspired me. So as we're coming to the end of our interview, being Product Hunt, I cannot let you leave without asking you about the products that you love. We've already heard about mechanical keyboards. So maybe other types of hardware or apps that, you know, you depend on to get through your workday or that help you in your personal life. You know, those products that you can't live without.
Yeah. So the first one that comes to mind is Bear, the app Bear, that I use for pretty much all of my notes and organization of things. And what's great about Bear is it's kind of your typical note-taking app that uses Markdown. You type things, it works. But what's great about it is how you can organize your notes. It uses hashtags. And so I can hashtag a note, whether it be like notes from the church service, I do hashtag church, or notes for project ideas, I can do hashtag projects, or notes that are like a certain family member's favorite things. I can do family/Cammy for my sister or something like that. And it'll organize all of your notes for you. And some people use it for like character development where they can infinitely nest different hashtags and combine different things to be just like, okay, in chapter 1, we cover these different characters. This character has this attribute. people organize all sorts of things, just to-do lists for their day. Myself, I use it every single project idea that I have. I just have a project idea hashtag that I use for myself. I combine notes in it all the time. I have a to-do list for the day for it. I've done my own little like project management in it, where as I come up with a project idea that I'm fleshing out, I'll put screenshots and draft things in there. What I've really loved using it for is for trip planning. Whenever I want to plan like a trip to a conference, I can put all of my flight information in there, put all of my hotel information, put addresses, schedules, things. I always put it together in there, and you can export bare notes to almost any format. I always do PDF, but you can also export it to even a WordPress blog or to a text file, to a Markdown file, to a Microsoft Word file. I love Bear. My friends are probably tired of hearing me talk about it because I love it so much, but Bear is probably my number one favorite software right now. In terms of hardware, I've talked about keyboards so much. One that I think you might be interested in that I'll just throw in there. There's a keyboard that just came out called the Mercury Rocketeer, and Ooh. It's based on a typewriter, and it has like a really heavy aluminum frame in it, and it looks awesome. So check that one out.
Nice.
Also, I recently got a new set of headphones called the Sennheiser 6XX. I'm wearing them right now. I wouldn't recommend them for like an open office environment because they're open back. But what's great about them is the sound is super clear, and I really like that they're open back. So headphones can be open back, closed back, where if you have silencing headphones, they're probably closed back because they kind of close you out from the world. But with open back, you kind of get more ambient sound around you, where you can still listen to really clearly or whatever you're listening to very clearly, but also still hear the world around you. And it's great because, for example, if my husband's cooking upstairs or if the doorbell rings and stuff while I'm working from home, I can still hear the world around me, but also still have music going and things happening in my head too.
Oh, that's amazing. I feel like there's a like headphones war happening at the moment. You know, there's so much innovation in like audio technology. So I'm definitely going to check those out. But I also feel overwhelmed by the incredible amount of choices that are available right now.
Audiophile organization of the world. I shouldn't even say organization, just community. That's even deeper than keyboards, I think. Like I dipped my toe into it when I got these headphones and I was just like, I can't do this. This will be way too Man, people get so specific about their headphones, about their amplifiers for their headphones, about like tweaking every single living thing of their workspace so that way they can listen to things with the most perfect clarity. And I get it.
Oh, wow.
I one time visited someone's office that had like probably one of the most expensive headphone setups I've ever seen. It was like $1,500 worth of equipment just to listen
to.
It was crazy. But then like, they were just like, okay, let's play some Nora Jones or something. And it was like she was singing to it, like in the room. It was spectacular, but I don't know if it's worth that much cash. So, I mean, you could say that about anything. Someone's probably just like, look who's talking with you and your 9 keyboards. But that community gets deep.
Yeah. Wow. Great. Well, I mean, what an hour, what an interview. This has been incredible. Thank you so much for sharing all your amazing experiences, all of your tips, mechanical keyboards 101, and your favorite products. Just before we wrap up, where can folks find you if they want to follow you or just kind of stay posted on what you're working on?
Yeah, so Cassidou is where you can find me. My handle on Twitter and everything pretty much is Cassidou, CASSIDOO. You could look up Cassidy Williams. There's me and a Scooby-Doo character, and I'm not the Scooby-Doo character, so you'll probably find me. And then I also have a newsletter where I send interview questions, technical interview questions, jokes, the latest links of the week that I found, and that's at tinyletter.com/Cassidou. Yeah, that's where you can find me.
Amazing. Well, thank you again so much on behalf of Product Hunt for joining us on Product Hunt Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.